To 2 Samuel chapter 2. Now, often in life, the promise of God and the providence of God seems at variance. They seem to conflict. And you have something of that conflict or seeming conflict in the life of David. For way back in 1 Samuel chapter 16, David was anointed king. And yet ever since that moment, it seems as if providence has thrown everything against him to stop him becoming king. Here we are in 2 Samuel, Saul is dead. And we automatically assume, well, doesn't that mean now's the chance David is going to be made king of all Israel? Or are there more problems to face? What will providence do? And he has already suffered more than a decade of troubles. We sometimes forget that all this trouble has been going on for at least 10 years and more. And as we shall see, he doesn't yet get all that God promised. So our subject is almost, but not all. Almost, but not all. But before we look at this section, I want to remind you of the overall context. The construction of this is very important. Chapter 2, verse 1 refers to Hebron. And so it is Hebron right through until chapter 5, verse 5. So Hebron is sort of like the two bookends of this particular section. And then in between those two sides, we have the following pattern. We have David mentioned, chapter 2, verses 1 to 7. Then Ishbosheth, chapter 2, verses 8 to 11. And then a very long section from chapter 2, verse 12, right through to chapter 3, the last verse, regarding Abner. So it's David, Ishbosheth, Abner, and then in reverse, Ishbosheth, chapter 4, and David, chapter 5, verses 1 to 5. So the construction of this whole section is very, very important. So you understand, as we go along, how the material, under the inspiration of God, has been put together. There's nothing haphazard about the way this is all constructed. So coming then to these first 11 verses, we notice first of all, in verses 1 to 3, the inquiry by God's king. It came to pass after this that David inquired of the Lord. And he asks God two basic questions. First, what shall I do? And second, where shall I go? Very simple but delightful questions that are so basic to his existence and to his entire future. Saul is dead, so what do I do now and where do I go? And it reminds us that the mark of God's people is one of dependence. Depending upon God to seek guidance from God, not taking any major step or indeed any small step or any size of step without first asking God for wisdom and guidance, blessing, as well as direction. So everything is committed to God. And if we're unsure, seek the face of God. We need wisdom and help. You see, failure to do that often brings disaster. And I'm sure all of you can look back through your life and say, there were times I made a decision, but I never stopped to inquire from God. Was this the right decision? I never stopped to ask for wisdom in the making of that decision. But we rushed on ahead. We made the decision because we thought we knew better. And then over a long period of time, it all comes home, I suppose, like chickens to roost, reminding us what a failure we were. Remember, it was David's God-less thinking in chapter 27 that placed him in so much danger. At other times he inquired of God, got an answer from God, but in chapter 27 he went on ahead himself. And the result was he placed himself in danger and ended up acting deceitfully, deceiving those around him. He was in such a mess, only Providence could get him out of it. Only Providence. He could not get out of it himself. And the wonderful thing is, Providence used the Philistines to get him out of the hole that he put himself in. It's a wonder of God's mercy towards his own. Well, here he is at a crossroads in life. Well, what do you do when you're at a crossroads? He stops sufficiently long to ask God for guidance. What shall I do? Where shall I go? And God sends him to Hebron. The word simply means society, friendship. So Hebron is a very special place. But historically, it was precious. Historically, it was important. It's where Abraham and Isaac and Sarah were buried. But why would God send him to Hebron? He wasn't sending him to a graveyard to have a look at the tombs of his ancestors, much as I'm sure that was quite nice for him. But that's not why he sent him. And sending him to Hebron, he was reminding him, the God of Abraham is your God. That's why he sent him to Hebron. The same unchangeable God that ruled over Abraham of old is the same God ruling today. Isn't that wonderful? Isn't that precious? The God of Abraham and the God of Isaac, that's your God. That's what God is saying to David. I am the God of thy fathers, Abraham and Isaac. The same sovereign, covenant-keeping, unchanging God who loves his people, who keeps his promise, who's faithful to the end. That's why he sent him to Hebron. So Hebron is special. It's a special place on the earth. Our Puritan forefathers, they had special places. They would remember and tell their children, you know, under that oak tree, I prayed for you before you were born. And I give you to God, even when you're in the womb. They would do things like that. We don't do that. We're too busy to do it. We don't do that because, well, we've got everything else to hand, so it doesn't really matter. We should do it more often. Not that the place is sacred in any way, but as a reminder to us, we are pilgrims on a journey, and we need God. And God says to Abram, I am your God. And he says to David, I am your God. He's the same. The inquiry by God's king. But then secondly, the crowning of God's king. In verse 4, we're told, the men of Judah came, and there they anointed David king over the house of David. Judah crowns him king. It was a bold move. It's a step of faith, a mark of zeal, but more significantly for us, it's not so much what Judah did, it's what it means. What does it mean? It means that God's king now visibly rules on earth. That's what it means. God's king visibly ruling on the earth. It may only be one tribe. That's all it is at the moment. One tribe. It may be a very small thing in the eyes of the world. It is small. I mean, what is Judah? Among the thousands of Israel, what is Judah? Among all the nations of the world, what is Judah? It is a small tribe in a small place. But it's significant. And the significance of it reaches beyond Hebron and Judah. It's God's king visibly ruling in God's kingdom on this earth. That's what it means. Now you and I have the advantage of knowing where it's all going to go and how it's all going to turn out. It's all going to turn out that Christ himself comes. But that's a long way off. This is the starting point. What have we got here? We have but a stump. We have a shoot, so to speak. Just a little sprig, a twig on the earth. That's all we're starting with, just a stump. But it's going to grow and it's going to develop and it's going to expand and it's going to continue until David's greater son comes. And then the kingdom of Christ will be throughout all the earth until all the kingdoms of the world bow to the kingdom of Christ. But here's the starting point. And it is of fundamental importance that we mark this evening, that we take note of it, that we don't actually forget this starting point. Of course, we can read on through the Old Testament and we'll rush on to the Gospels and we'll hear the grand announcement, the kingdom of heaven has come. And we'll run on past the cross, we get to the book of Acts, we see the kingdom extending. But let's pause sufficiently long in 2 Samuel 2 to grasp the starting point. See its importance. See its beginning. It's like, shall we put it, a cloud the size of a man's hand. It isn't very big. Doesn't seem much. But God's king is crowned on earth. And then thirdly, from the end of verse 4 right through to verse 7, the invitation of God's king, Jabesh Gilead, belonged to the half-tribe of Manasseh, small and insignificant. Remember when they were in danger of being wiped out in 1 Samuel 11 by the Ammonites. And their deliverance was a grand deliverance. And we had that famous phrase that was issued at that time. The Lord hath wrought salvation in Israel. It was a triumphant note. The more well-known form of it is, salvation is of the Lord. The Lord hath wrought salvation in Israel. It's a triumphant note. It was a grand declaration, a great proposition of the mighty works of God. Well, from chapter 11, they seem to disappear from the narrative. They're no longer at the forefront of things. And then they suddenly reappear when Saul dies. And their act of bravery is noted in 1 Samuel 31, verses 11 to 13. It's a wonderful way to finish 1 Samuel. It's a reminder to us that in the midst of defeat and death and destruction that was visited upon Israel on Mount Gilboa, the lamp of Israel still burned. There was still faith and gratitude and courage. And how encouraging that is for us. No matter what destruction is wrought upon the earth, the lamp will still burn. And what they didn't, or what they did do, doesn't amount to much, perhaps. At least on the surface of things. Doesn't seem to be much. But it was a bold statement. Amidst the carnage and the wreckage, it was there upon Mount Gilboa. And it wasn't forgotten. Here we are in chapter 2. and it's being reminded and recorded afresh and spoken of. What does David do in light of that? He sends them an invitation. Come, unite with Judah under me as your king. Do you know there's a winsomeness to this invitation? It points us forward, does it not, to the winsomeness of the other King David and his invitation that he issues. The four simple things about this invitation, we can say it was a gracious invitation according to verse 5. Blessed be ye of the Lord that ye have showed kindness unto your Lord. It's a gracious invitation. And then we will say, secondly, it was a fulsome invitation. And now the Lord show kindness and truth unto you. Not just kindness, but kindness and truth. It's a full invitation that he says to them. And it's a promissory invitation. I will do you good, he says. And I also will requite you this kindness. Because you have done this thing. And finally, it's a decisive invitation. They have to do something about it. Verse 7. Now, therefore, let your hands be strengthened and be ye valiant. For your master Saul is dead. And also the house of Judah have anointed me king over them. It's a decisive invitation. You have to do something about it, he says. Come. Come and join with Judah. Come and bow to God's king. That's what he's saying to them. There's a winsomeness to the invitation. But what was their response? Everything for Jabesh hinges on their response. Scripture doesn't tell us. The invitation of God's king. And then fourthly, verses 8 to 11, the rejection of God's king. The rejection of God's king. It is absolutely astonishing that Abner makes Ishbosheth king in Israel. It's understandable, yes, it is understandable, yet astonishing nonetheless. It's logical, but still wrong. It's understandable in the sense that the practice is that when a king dies, his son becomes his successor. A dynastic mentality. It was dynastically normal, and yet it was still wrong. It's wrong because Abner knew. He knew that God had given the kingdom to David. And he draws attention to it himself in chapter 3, verses 9 and 10. So he knew that God had promised the kingdom to David. And he knew that Saul's house was finished. There was not meant to be another successor. But perhaps he had reasons for what he did. We could speculate like this. We could say, well, maybe he feared a power vacuum. So he steps in. Isn't that often the argument made by politicians and other people? A power vacuum. If you don't fill the vacuum with some leader, then the gangsters will take over. Well, he's a man, Abner. He's head of the army. So what did the army do? Well, they take over, don't they? So perhaps he said, well, this is the wisest thing to do. But perhaps it was also his chance to be kingmaker. There are some, and they like to be in the background. They don't want to be the king, but they like to be the kingmaker because the king becomes their puppet. They pull the strings. We get a hint of that in chapter 3. Because Ishbosheth was in fact afraid of Abner, we are told. But however he thought, whatever he thought, and why he thought what he thought.
He was defying God. That's what he was doing. He was defying the living God. And it was a gigantic tragedy in more ways than one. It becomes a gigantic tragedy for Abner, but it's also a gigantic tragedy for Israel, where it is the commencement of conflict and of civil war. But what about Jabez? What did Jabez do in all of this? We don't know what they did, because Abner had seized the initiative. What we do know is the house of Judah followed David. We're told that. See how often that is repeated. The house of Judah followed David in verse 10. The writer is saying to you, that's what you keep your eye on. See all these other events I'm telling you about that are also important in and of themselves, but don't be distracted by it to the point that you forget this salient and significant matter. The house of Judah followed David. Keep your eye on that. As you turn aside from time to time to study other events, don't lose sight of this. The house of Judah followed David. They had crowned God's king, and they're going to be loyal to God's king, and they're going to stick with God's king no matter what else is going on. You keep your eye on that, he says. And we're told in verse 11 that this contest between these two kingdoms will last for over 7 years. The writer is saying over this next 7 year period, don't forget this principle. Don't forget this truth. God's king has been crowned on earth. And God's king will not be overthrown. Well, what do we make of all of this? What's it say to us here today, this evening, in the 21st century? Well, it says the following things. First, for your encouragement, it says to you, don't despise the day of small things. Do not despise it even in our own local context. What are we? We're but one congregation with a mission station in another county. Doesn't seem a lot, does it? Here we are in the middle of a sea of hedonism that has engulfed, it seems, the entire evangelical community. But don't forget your history. 1733. I've taken most of you, I think, to it. Lyle Hill, one minister from Scotland, seceder. That's all it was. And then he had a mission station. And a second and a third. People mocked and laughed. But by 1840, the laughter had stopped. Might have taken a while. Don't despise small beginnings. When Christ's kingdom is considered in the book of Acts, what do you make of it? You know, they could put the whole church in one room, 120 of them, in an upper room. That's all it was. We're told that. The number of the names gathered, 120. And they could all fit into an upper room. But it didn't stay like that, sure it didn't. Look at it now. From Jerusalem, we might say to Duch, it has extended. Isn't that something? Down through the centuries? Right across the world? Into China, Russia, Iceland, across the globe it has gone. From an upper room. Don't despise small things. Here it is, just a stump. Just a shoot. That's all it is. But then secondly, for your humiliation. Abner knew what was right.
yet he didn't do it. Many of us are like Abner. We could call it the education fallacy. The belief that if only people knew more, had enough information in their heads, then they would make not only informed decisions, but the right decisions. It's the education fallacy. You just but give people information, they'll do the right thing. It's complete nonsense. Abner knew what the right thing was. Abner knew what he should have done. But he didn't do it nonetheless. That doesn't mean, of course, that you don't inform. But you ought always to remember that knowledge is not enough. There needs to be a heart for that knowledge. Abner knew. In fact, not only did Abner know, he was convinced it was right. He knew that David was going to be king. He says that God has promised him to be king. Well, why didn't he turn around and say, "I'm going to make him king? Because I'm in charge of the army." But he didn't do it. Can any of us say, "Oh, I've never been like that. Soon as God shows me a thing, I instantly do it"? Can all of us say that? Can we look back over our lives and say, "I've always been obedient to the word of God. Soon as I've been convicted about a thing, I've always obeyed"? It's not true, sure it's not. You can know what the Bible tells you to do and yet still not do it. And Abner, do we not see something of ourselves? What do we need? We need a heart. That's what we need. "Oh, that my people had a heart," says God in Deuteronomy. That's what we need to pray for. That we have a love for it. That our affections are bent towards it. That's what we need. Not just the mind, the intellect informed, but the affections turned towards it. So that the will comply with what we know. And then thirdly, for your instruction, what Abner did wasn't a one-off event. It wasn't like as if, "Well, I'll crown Ishbosheth king and that's all there is to it, and then I can go home, put my feet up." What it tells us is that it's typical of the warfare between God's kingdom and man's kingdom. Between God's king and man's king. Who was God's king? David. Who is man's king? Ishbosheth. Here's the conflict of the ages encapsulated in this one event. It's the conflict that's been going on since Genesis 3. The conflict of the ages. Man's kingdom at war with God's kingdom. Man's king fighting God's king, like Psalm 2, for example. Isn't that what it tells us in Psalm 2? "Kiss the son," it says, "lest they be angry with you." Bow to the king. But how does it start? "Why do the heathen rage? And the people imagine a vain thing." There's a conflict that's going on all the time. It's Augustine's point, isn't it? In the city of God, there's the city of man and the city of God. One's at war with the other. Rebellion against God's king. And this king has issued an invitation. We might put it in this form. "Take my yoke upon you." That's the invitation. Come and bow to a gracious king. Have we seriously bowed to this king? You know, to defy man's king and man's kingdom takes courage. Look at Judah, one little tribe. To defy Abner took courage. Because Abner had the army. He could have overthrown Judah. He had everybody else behind him.
tells us that. All the other tribes said, yes, we'll follow Ish-bosheth.
To defy man's kingdom takes courage.
So everybody had to take sides. Who are they going to side with? You're going to side with David or Ish-bosheth? And isn't that always the challenge? It's the challenge to us as adults. Perhaps we have come through the challenge and we now say, I have sided with Jesus Christ, the King of Kings. But you know, our children face the same challenge. Day after day, in the playground, in the street, they're constantly being challenged. Who do you side with? Every day they're being tested. Yesterday you said you stood with Christ. Do you still stand with Christ? That's why we need to pray for our children. You know, as they grow up from 5 years old to 15 and 25 and 35, we need to pray for them that in all these early years, as they struggle and strive to take a stand at 5, they will do it at 15, and they will do it at 18, and they will do it at 25 and 35. We need to do that. We need to have a heart for them, because they're always being tested. Who do you side with? And yes, it might be okay for us as we get older. We don't care anymore what anybody else thinks. We cease to worry about it. It doesn't bother us anymore. We've long sided with Christ. But even yet in the workplace, don't God's people face the same challenge? Who are you standing with? You said last week you were a Christian. Are you still a Christian? Are you still of the same mind? Everybody here has to make a decision. I wonder what points and principles people would have considered. What do you think the tribe of Judah thought when they said, we're going to make David king? We're going to crown him in Hebron. So they come, the tribe comes to Hebron where David is, and they crown him king. What do you think moved them? Could we not say God's promise moved them? The fact that God had set his king apart. I've set my king upon the holy hill of Zion. Would they not have said, God has made this man king? This is God's king. We want to bow to him. Would they not have said that? The one after God's own heart will follow him. Not the one after man's heart. Ish-bosheth, Abner. So we'll stand with God's king. There's a lot in this, isn't there? We've only scratched the surface of its significance. You know, as you and I go through life, as we observe events, as we see the state of the church, don't be discouraged. Mourn, yes, but don't be discouraged. The kingdom of God does not depend on us. The kingdom of God has come, and it will keep on coming until it has covered the entire earth. May God bless his word to our hearts.